title is The Valley of Sin. And the reason we're picking the idea of a valley is because as we go through the book of Romans, we're likening it to climbing a mountain. And we are where the arrow is today, in the valley, before the mountain. Now, I have never climbed a mountain, but I have driven through the Alps. And the person with me said I was a disastrously bad driver. And she almost had kittens. She was my landlady at the time. But you see the roads there. But what I do know is this. Before you go up a big mountain, first, often you have to go down, maybe 1,000 feet down into a valley first, before you can start climbing. And in the valley there would have been a glacier or something. And Paul is saying in the first three chapters of Romans this. The first three chapters of Romans lead us down into the valley of sin, where we learn the bad news of how low humans have gone. All of us begin somewhere in the valley of sin. Not everyone is as sinful as anyone else, but we're all, before God, disqualified. We need to first hear the bad news about ourselves in the valley before we can see our need for the good news of Jesus. Then we are empowered by Jesus to ascend the mountain. Okay, so that's why we're looking at the valley today. Now, I wanted to say this. I don't know if any of you have ever been in a valley that's had echoes. If you shout, particularly in mountainous valleys, if you shout, or you do the yodel, you know that thing, you get an echo. Well, I want to tell you that the first verses in the book of Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, which describes this valley of sinful humanity, is full of echoes. Echoes from the book of Genesis, particularly Genesis chapter 3, where Adam and Eve basically put their fingers up at God. There are echoes in the valley of Genesis 3. Echoes of the fall in Eden. So here are some. I just was quite surprised when I read this. So I didn't know this about these verses. Paul is thinking about Adam and Eve as the beginning of the whole problem. It says this in verse 21. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now that happened in the Garden of Eden. But it also, ever since, is happening throughout the human race. But it began, if you want to say when is Paul writing about? Well, I think he's thinking it began in Eden. Here's another echo of Genesis. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, and creeping things. And if you remember, that is harking back to Genesis when God began with the creeping things, then the animals, then the birds, then man. These are the categories of Genesis chapter 1, not just chapter 3. But Paul is thinking back and he's saying with these verses, man has worshipped the things that God made instead of God. He's exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images. And then lastly, another echo. It says in verse 25 of Romans chapter 1, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. And in the original language, I looked this up, in the original Greek, verse 25 should say this. They exchanged the truth about God for the lie. The lie, which is the lie of Satan. And in the Garden of Eden, Satan gave a lie to Adam and Eve. He said, you can be your own God. You can be your own master. You don't need this God. You can be God yourself, your own God. And that's the lie that began then and has since infected all human beings down through history. Now, I want to just look at going down into the valley. Three stages that Paul points out of humanity going down into this valley of sin. First one is this. that God has revealed himself. God has revealed himself. It says in verse 20, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse." According to Paul, people know that there's a God. Now, you might meet an atheist or an agnostic. You know, they would never admit this. They would say, well, I don't know. But according to Paul, they do know, but what they've done is they've suppressed it. They've buried it. But if you look at nature and creation, you think, wow, there is a God. And I believe, like in that top corner picture, God is like an artist. And if you look at a painting, I mean, my Daniela, our youngest daughter, she's an artist. If you look at some of her paintings, you can work out some of her personality from what she's painted. And you can see God's personality through the amazingness of creation. God has left his fingerprints all over creation. And if you're a scientific buff, like somebody I know, not me, but I know someone who's quite into physics, and they told me that the Big Bang, if you believe that God started everything with the Big Bang, but the Big Bang, which scientists believe is how God began it, had to happen at such a precise rate of expansion that if it was a millisecond too fast, we would have been nothing but hydrogen atoms millions of miles apart. And if it was a millisecond too slow, everything would have collapsed in on itself again. And they can't believe, these atheists, how could the Big Bang be so perfectly calibrated? I think the maths is 1 × 10⁻⁴, whatever that means. It's so precise. And but you see, God chose the numbers. It's impossible, the Big Bang, except if you believe God did it that way. I mean, I don't know. But God chose the numbers. So creation, God has revealed himself to people with creation. Also, the moral conscience. Everyone has a conscience. Everyone knows what's right and wrong, at least to start with. It might get a bit blurred later, but they know. C.S. Lewis said, "A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line." You know, people know what's right and wrong. They know it's wrong deep down. Conscience is another thing, how God has... If there is a conscience, then surely there is an ultimate right and wrong in God. Okay, the next step down the valley. Humans reject God. And it says in chapter 1, verse 18, it talks about those who suppress the truth. Now, if you go to the British Museum, has anyone ever been to the British Museum? Yeah. Well, there's loads of statues in the British Museum. There's loads of idols. Okay, of all these different little gods that people worship. Now, the argument that the British Museum give you is this. They say to you, this was man in the beginning when he was searching for God. He was trying this, he was trying that. He was looking for God, and he made these little statues as he searched out God. It was like man in his infancy, seeking the true God. But you know, that's not what Paul says. Paul says no. Paul says they knew the true God and they decided to replace him and substitute him with other gods, and they decided to suppress the truth. So the statues are a product of people suppressing the truth about God, replacing God with something else. It says they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things, rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. You see, sin isn't just doing bad things. Sin is replacing God with something else that isn't God. It's substituting God. We call them idols. John Calvin said this, a great reformer. He said, our hearts are a perpetual factory of idols. You know, man and woman are hardwired to worship. They have to worship something. And if they don't worship God, they will worship career or body image or work or sport Some people worship sport. Now, I know we've got some football fans in the room. I'm not having a dig. But I love what Bill Shankly once said. He was the Liverpool manager, if you know. He said this. Some people think football is a matter of life and death. I assure you, it's much more serious than that. You know, for him, it was everything. But, you know, people replace God with idols. If you don't worship God, you'll worship something else. It could be family. It could be all manner of things. But God says, I want first place. And then finally, judgment. An unpopular word. We don't like the word judgment these days. It's very unfashionable to talk about judgment. But it's in this book. God's wrath is revealed. Now, I want to tell you about this word wrath, because wrath is a very unfashionable word. We like to hear about God's love, and he is love. But on the other side of the coin, he has got wrath, because if you care about people, if you love people, you will be saddened and angered when people are ruined and broken. So God's wrath and anger is an extension, it's like the second side of a coin, of his love, because he's saddened and angered if people are hurt. It makes him angry, and it makes him angry that people suppress the truth about him. It says in chapter 1, verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all godliness and wickedness of those who suppress the truth. Now, you've got to understand, the wrath of God is not something unhinged or wild. It's not like a drunken father lashing out at his children. It's not like a tyrannical boss lashing out at his employee. God's anger is measured, controlled, it's perfect, it's right, it's rightful, it's just. What makes him angry the most is when people suppress the truth, replace him with things that are not worthy of his name. It's because he loves people that he gets angry. It's like if someone were to hurt my daughter and punish, I would be angry because I love her. Not because I'm a wrathful person. And what's the judgment? What is this wrath when it works out? How does God judge people? Now, you might expect God to smite people and strike them down with a bolt of lightning. Well, that might happen very rarely. But the big way God seems to judge in this book is he lets people go. He says, okay, you want that? Go and get it. He lets them go. He opens the door and lets them go. Do you remember the story of the prodigal son? The prodigal son said, I want my inheritance. And what did the father do? He said, okay, off you go. That is God's judgment. God can use it to bring people to their senses, which he did with the prodigal son. But God seems to give them up or give them over to it. It says three times God gave them over. Let me just read those to you. Verse 24, this is the judgment working its way out. God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. He said, okay, you want that? You can have it. And I want to warn us that we can get in this life what we really want. If we really want something, God might actually let us get it, and that's quite scary. It says, God gave them over to shameful lusts in verse 26. And that word shameful lusts, it means obsessions or over desires. You know, if you fixate on something long enough, God might just give it to you. And it works its way out. This is just one example Paul points out in the sexual realm. It says, even their women exchange natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. That is just one example Paul uses. He does seem to pick up on homosexuality. But it's just one among many. It's not, he's not having a go necessarily at just those people. He's saying if you give yourself to something, God might actually let you have it. And then at the bottom there, it says they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. He gave them over to a depraved mind, that they do what ought not to be done. Now, Paul, as I've said, he picks on the sexual realm, not because he's having a go at people who have same-sex desires, or he's not having a go at people who are sexually deviant only. He's saying this is just one symptom of many symptoms. But he uses the sexual one, and it's a very hot topic today, isn't it? This topic. But he uses it as a case study to say if people run after their own desires, they will start not following God's pattern. And in Rome, in the year AD 64, Nero, he was a really sexually deviant chap. He actually proclaimed a summer festival in AD 64, where it was actively encouraged by the government to do whatever you like. You can abuse anyone you like, and it's law, and no one is allowed to resist. And it was absolutely horrific. It was wild living gone wild. But it's only one thing, the sexual. Here are some other things that Paul lists. Look, just quickly. It says, they have become filled with every kind of wickedness. Evil, greed, depravity. And here's the list. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossipers, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, that's faithfulness, no mercy. So see how low mankind has gone into this valley, rejecting their creator. Now, up till now, Paul has been talking about the general malaise of fallen, sinful humanity. But he's particularly been focusing, I guess, on the non-religious, the pagans, you know, the ones out in the world. That's what he's been speaking about. And I wonder if there were some religious people listening to this Roman letter when Phoebe first read it, some quite religious people who are thinking, well, I'm not like that. I'm well behaved. I'm upright. I'm moral. That doesn't apply to me. You know, there might be what I call the moralizers, the moral people, you know, who behave themselves very well. They have a pretty clean life on the outside. And they're quite smug. And they think, yeah, God should judge those pagans for doing all that crazy stuff. But I'm the well-behaved citizen. Well, Paul doesn't let anyone get away with it. He then turns the gun barrels onto the religious people in chapter 2. So in Romans 2, 1 to 16, Paul now turns to talk to the religious or moral person who believes they are better and superior. It's easy, isn't it, to think you're better than other people? You might not be as sinful in what you do, but according to God, we're all the same. It's very easy, isn't it, to think you're higher up the valley slope than someone else. It's very easy to fall into that mindset. What Paul does in chapter 2 is he throws a bucket of ice cold water over the religious moral person. Because he says these words, which what Ray read, chapter 2, at the beginning. You, therefore, have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else. For at whatever point you judge the other, you are condemning yourself. Because you who pass judgment do the same things. So when you, a mere man or woman, pass judgment on them, and yet do the same things, do you think you will escape God's judgment? What Paul is saying is you may not have done these things, but sometimes you've thought about it. So Jesus said, didn't he, you may not commit adultery, but you can lust after a woman in your heart. And he said, and if you've done it in your heart, you've done it. So God's standards are so high, everyone is disqualified, even the religious moral person who thinks they're good enough. I love the Message translation. This is what the Message translation says. Message translation said, if you think that leads you on the high ground where you can point your finger at others, think again. Every time you criticize someone, you condemn yourself. It takes one to know one. What's that phrase? The kettle calling the pot black. Takes one. And I always remember my landlady, the one I told you about, who I had to drive to Italy once, who thought I was a terrible driver. She once told me this. She said, if you point a finger at someone, you've always got three fingers pointing back at you. So Paul has addressed the pagans, the crazy ones. He's also addressed the moral ones, the religious ones. And then he goes to the Jews. If you read carefully, from chapter 2, verse 17, down to 3, verse 8, he turns the gun barrel now on the Jew. The Jew who's got God's law and who thinks self-confidently that I'm a good boy, I'm a good girl, I'm surely accepted by God because I'm a good Jew. They think their religious deeds put them in a different category. You know, I keep the Sabbath, I'm circumcised, I eat kosher food, I'm therefore much better, surely. Paul says no. We're all dead in our sins, all of us, even the Jew. And do you remember the story of the prodigal son that Jesus told in Luke 15? He told a story of a wayward, rebellious boy who left the father. And I can imagine that when Jesus told that story, there were Pharisees sitting there, religious Jews. And as they listened, they were going, yeah, that boy was bad. He deserves punishment. And they were quite smug. But you know the story at the end? Jesus then turns the focus on the older brother, who's the self-righteous one, the religious Jew, if you like, the Pharisee. He's represented by the older brother. And Jesus actually ends up saying the older brother was the one that was left out in the end. He was the one that was left out in the cold, wasn't invited into the party, or he was invited into the party, but he didn't want to come. But Paul is picking up on these themes and saying, even you Jews need to watch it. You need Christ. All of you need Christ. So Paul's conclusion about the valley is this. Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin. Elsewhere he says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. There is no difference. Okay, he's getting us ready for the good news, you see. That's what he's doing. Now, just to illustrate this a little bit further, imagine there are three swimmers, and they want to swim from Southampton to New York, which is rather a long way. Now, imagine the first swimmer at the back. She manages to swim, say, a mile, and then drowns. All right, gets to about there. That's more than a mile, isn't it? A few miles. The second swimmer is a pretty average swimmer. That person swims, maybe not as far as that, but strong swimmer, gets to about there. That's still a long way, isn't it? But the point I'm making is, and then they drown. Now, the last one, and the one at the front, she is a championship Olympic gold medalist swimmer. And she swims, and she swims, and she swims, and she swims. She manages to swim, what, 100 miles? 150 miles? And then she drowns. Okay, here's the question. Which one is more drowned than the other? They're all drowned. And that's what God is saying through this passage. He said, I don't care if you are a pagan who sleeps around and gets drunk and does all kinds of things. I don't care if you're a moral person, a good person, who maybe doesn't act like that. And I don't care if you're a nice, well-behaved Jew. You're all drowned. You all need the gospel. And then Paul concludes our section for today with some quite offensive scriptures. What do you think of this verse? There is no one who does good. Not even one. Now, a lot of people go, that's not right. I do good. I'm a good person. My neighbour used to say to me all the time, I'm a good person. I think what Paul is saying is this. There is no one who does good 100% of the time. Yeah, we can all do good. But sometimes your motive has been defiled. Like, I might help an elderly lady across the road, maybe because I want to look good to my friend. Or maybe because I hope she'll give me a fiver. But our motives are sometimes defiled. And no one except Jesus did good 100% of the time. Sometimes we do good because it makes us feel good. Like I might take the lady across the road. I might genuinely want to help her. Or I might do it because it helps me feel good. So that's what Paul is saying here. And we all struggle, I think, to say or to admit that we're not good. I want to tell you about a full TV program. Now, in the program, what they do is they attach a lie detector to a person and they ask them questions. And if they always answer the truth, they get money. And then you can win a lot of money. So they got this lady, I won't give her name. I do know her name, but I won't name her because she's already been in the news. But she was tied up to, she was put on this polygraph lie detector, and someone, the presenter asked her, he said, have you ever stolen anything from your workplace? And, you know, the bosses are probably in the audience, and she's like, yeah, I have. And the lie detector said, true, correct. And she won £50,000 of saying that, or dollars. And then there was a really bad question. They asked her, they said, have you ever cheated on your husband? For $100,000, answer truthfully, have you ever cheated on your husband? And she was there, and she went, yeah, I have. And the husband was in the audience, and the husband went, he was a New York police officer, you couldn't believe it. But anyway, she got £100,000 for doing that. Or she thought she did. You only win the money, though, if you get all the way to the end, so you have to get all the answers true to win the money. If you get anything, if you lie at all during it, you lose the lot. So she got a broken marriage now and $100,000, possibly. Then they asked her this last question. For $200,000, they said to her, do you think you are a good person? And she waited and she said, yeah, I think I'm a good person. You know, despite everything that happened. And then the lie detector said, false! Lie! Now, isn't it amazing that she probably knew deep down she wasn't good, but she couldn't admit it. But the lie detector picked up that stress in her. And I think we all can be like that. We can say, I can't admit that I'm a good person. I'm not a good person. I can't admit it that I'm not that good. And that can keep us away from Jesus. What we have to do is come to the place where we say, I need Christ, whether I'm good, bad, or ugly. I need Christ. And the final verse, or near the very end of today's section, chapter 3, verse 19, Paul concludes basically by saying this, every mouth may be silent and the whole world held accountable to God. So Paul is basically saying no one has any excuse, though everyone needs Jesus. So, and he got this image of a person putting their hand over their mouth. And that was in the Roman law courts. In the Roman law courts, when a defendant had nothing more to say and no excuses and no more wriggling room and no more defense, they would do this. Apparently it was a tradition in Roman law. If you put your hand over your mouth, it meant guilty as charged. And that is the point of Romans chapters 1 to 3. Now, I know it's been all bad news today, but isn't it good sometimes to have confession? Confession's good for the soul. I mean, I'm glad Debbie did the confession today. It's good to be honest. If we're honest with God and say, yeah, I'm not perfect, Lord, then it opens the door to God and to true friendships as well. So it has been bad news today. But that's the truth. All have sinned. But here's the good news. We're going to finish with this. But all are welcome. All have sinned, but all are welcome. Because Christ died for them